Welcome to Berlin Inside Out, the podcast that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany, with me, Benjamin Tallis.
And me, Aaron Gash-Burnett. Hello and welcome back to Berlin Inside Out, the foreign affairs podcast with the German Council on Foreign Relations that takes an expert look at how Germany sees the world and the world sees Germany. I'm Aaron Gash-Burnett, a journalist and security analyst specializing in German politics and foreign policy, and I'm here as always with my friend and co-host, Benjamin Tallis, senior research fellow here at the Council and head of its action group, Zeitenwende. Ben, one of the main reasons there even is a Berlin Inside Out at all is that Russia's invasion of Ukraine laid bare how the West, and particularly Germany, has been consistently wrong about how to both engage with Central and Eastern Europe as well as to deter Russia for decades. And it's made this mistake, I would say, in two clear ways. One is by overestimating Russia, and the other is by underestimating Ukrainian resilience in particular, as well as the citizens of other countries who have lived under Soviet and Russian occupation.
That's right, Aaron. But I actually think the problem goes even deeper than that. And I think the last 2 years have really laid bare this lack of understanding for why we should be even defending democracy and freedom, let alone how we can actually go about doing it. And while Ukrainians have been doing the fighting and dying, something that, it has to be said, has provided something of a wake-up call to a lot of people in the West, as well as an inspiring example, and we're going to hear more about that later, too many of our leaders are still dithering and holding out on Ukraine. And as regular listeners to the show will know, the approach of the German government is a case in point. At the beginning, Germany was slow to react or even to work out why it should. And then we went through the insult of the 5,000 helmets. And eventually, after the Zeitenwende speech, after the Scholz government dragged its feet every step of the way, after much kicking and screaming, we did get to the delivery of heavy weapons, but only after extreme pressure was really applied by allies and after Ukraine's resilience, its resistance, had given us the chance to supply Ukraine. But now here we are stuck again in Groundhog Day with the same lame excuses being wheeled out for why Germany shouldn't deliver Taurus cruise missiles as were made last year or back in 2022 for why Berlin shouldn't send Leopard tanks.
Leopards.
That's right. And shockingly, though not surprisingly, Olaf Scholz has still not said that Ukraine should win the war. And that shows in the German government's approach, as we've talked about on previous episodes. And I think that's really why, despite having spent a lot of money and despite being in absolute terms the biggest European donor and military donor to Ukraine, Germany doesn't get the credit that Olaf Scholz thinks it deserves.
56 billion and little to show, as you've said before.
That's right. It's a really expensive way to damage your country's reputation as well as to make Europe less safe. And unless that changes and Germany commits to Ukraine's victory and thus to this goal shared by allies from the Baltics to Britain, from Finland to France, now we've seen very strongly committing the joint op-ed between David Cameron and Stéphane Séjourné yesterday, just actually recommitting to that, saying Russia must be defeated in Ukraine. So unless Germany actually commits to that common goal, it will remain just that, an expensive way to damage Germany's reputation and make Europe less safe. But I think the problem is, like those misreadings that you mentioned before, of Russia, of Central and Eastern Europe, which we've talked about on the show, and of Ukraine, and this lack of understanding for both the threat to freedom and democracy, and why as well as how we should defending it, this all combines to mean that the Scholz government is really unlikely to change course, as its key decision makers simply lack the understanding of the stakes involved. They lack the understanding of the urgency or the reason why this war has to be won. Now, both of us, and thankfully also many others here in Berlin, see that as a major problem and one that needs to be overcome, including by continually explaining what is the situation in Ukraine, what is its wider geopolitical context, what's at stake, what we can do about it, and why we should.
And Ben, that is why it is a tremendous privilege for us to welcome to the show an outstanding, world-leading journalist whose work has highlighted all of these elements that we've just talked about right now. So from the frontline experience to the political context. And joining us this week is Yaroslav Trofimov. He is the chief foreign affairs correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, a paper he has been with since 1999. He was a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for his work covering his native Ukraine and the author of three books. The most recent of those books is called Our Enemies Will Vanish. The title is actually taken from the Ukrainian national anthem, and it is a book about Russia's brutal assault and what he calls Ukraine's War of Independence. It's about Ukrainian resilience against all odds, which defied Western expert opinion here before February 2022, and also defied the political judgments being passed in Berlin and elsewhere on the morning of the 24th of February 2022.
That's right. We remember the Ukrainian ambassador being told in several different ministries in Berlin, there's no point helping you because you're going to lose within days.
Yeah, exactly. Or even hours in some cases, as the assumption was. Your book contains many riveting, sobering, but also hopeful stories, not just from Ukrainian politicians like Zelensky and his inner circle, but everyday Ukrainian civilians and soldiers during many trips to the front lines. And it also makes extremely clear the difference that Western assistance, that particular types of heavy weapons like HIMARS, like Leopard tanks, made in helping Ukraine not only hold out, but also in pushing Russia back. The book also makes equally clear the negative consequences, the deterioration in the military situation and the human suffering caused by the delays in providing various types of weapons that Ukraine has requested over and over again. And I know we're both honored to have you here to talk about your book and Western, including German policy in Ukraine. Yaroslav, welcome to Berlin and welcome to the show.
Great to be on the show. Thank you for having me.
It really is great to have you here, and really congratulations on the book, and thank you for the book. I think it's absolutely essential reading, and having lived and worked in Ukraine myself, it brought back a lot of memories for me of places that I'd been to, the types of encounters that I'd had, albeit under different circumstances. And what really struck me was how much of a visceral experience it actually was to read. You really convey the feeling, the urgency, the tension that is there. And I mean, it's a cliche, but I really couldn't bring myself to put it down. So much so that I had a fair-sized car journey to make while I was reading it, I bought the audiobook version too and ended up listening to it in the car. But this backfired as chapters 5, 6, and 7 got so tense that I had to stop the car because it wasn't actually going to be safe to drive while paying proper attention to what was happening at Hostomel in those chapters in particular. And the we're still here moment also still sends shivers down my spine reading about it. And that's, I mean, something to note too, this viscerality of it, the closeness of experience. I mean, you've reported on many wars and conflicts and seen terrible things in different parts of the world, but this time was a little different. This was at home. You grew up in Kyiv. So can you tell us about that and about the experience of writing the book as well as your motivation to do so?
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry for your unsafe driving experience. I've spent much of my career, you know, for the last 23 years, covering wars and mayhem in other people's countries. You know, I was in Iraq during the invasion and during the, you know, the long and bloody war there. In the following years, I was running our bureau in Kabul, covering, you know, the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and plenty of other wars in between. And I was actually in Kabul in August 2021 as the American military was withdrawing. And I remember watching President Ashraf Ghani inspect the troops at the outskirts of Kabul and say, you know, we will fight to the last man. And then 12 hours later, he was in a helicopter heading to Uzbekistan at the Taliban were in my hotel. And within days, they were already taking possession of American weapons. And by the end of the following month, they were flying Black Hawks and driving around in MRAPs and Humvees. And I think those images are very much a factor determining American and Western policy in Ukraine in the following month. I think a lot of people, having seen how quickly the Afghan army collapsed and how all this, you know, plentiful American weaponry ended up in the wrong hands, were even more reluctant to provide weapons to Ukraine. And, you know, the few people at the time who were telling the administration, Washington and other capitals, that, well, Ukraine may have a chance, were unfortunately the very same people who were telling them that the Afghan army will hold out. And so they were discredited, I think, to a degree. And, you know, me myself, I have to be honest, you know, when I was in Kyiv, you know, the day of the invasion and seeing how everything was in utter chaos, you know, because people were just trying to figure out how to react, you know, and I had in the back of my mind this fear, what if President Zelensky does and Ashraf Ghani, President Zelensky, who was denying until the last moment that the war would erupt, what if he also flees? What if he also listens to the advice he was being given that very day by Western leaders, by, you know, Boris Johnson, you know, told me that, you know, I offered him to come to London and create a government in exile the way Poland had done in 1939. And maybe another president would have done that, because everybody knew that the Russians had infiltrated the Ukrainian society, the Ukrainian government. Nobody knew who's friend and foe. I mean, the West didn't know how the Ukrainians will react, but the Ukrainians also didn't know how the Ukrainians will react. You know, Zelensky's national security advisor at the time, Danilov, told me that, you know, the most difficult decision-making in the first hours of the invasion was trying to figure out who is on your side, who has switched, who hasn't, you know, who are the Russian assets and who are, and whom can you trust? And I think it took the Ukrainians a good 48 hours to figure out. And as you said, Zelensky so courageously coming out of this president administration and recording this video at the time where Russian television was saying he's already in Lviv or already in Europe and saying, no, we are here, we're not going anywhere. I think that really changed everybody's minds. And as for me personally, of course, it's much harder to cover a war in a country, in a city where you're born, where every little piece of geography has, you know, emotional meaning, where, you know, you remember, you know, your first kiss, your, like, the hospital you went to with your mother, you know, the school, and now all of a sudden, you know, you have to wear a flak jacket and a helmet, and it's a battlefield, and bombs are falling. Obviously, it's hard. But I think, on the other hand, it was an extra motivation to go places and see things and take risks that I probably wouldn't have taken in other people's wars. And again, like of all the conflicts, of most conflicts I've covered in my career at the Journal, I think this one had the biggest moral clarity because, you know, there were different shades of gray in other places, you know, in Afghanistan, Iraq, in Israel, Gaza. Whereas here, this was a very clear cut case of an invasion of a country that hadn't done anything to provoke it, hadn't ever threatened its neighbor, and, you know, was being destroyed.
Absolutely right. This point that you mention about working out who's on your side and so on, indeed, so our enemies will vanish, some of them from within, some of them from without. But in the past, it's been a case of, in times of need, Ukraine's friends have vanished too. And this is something that struck me. I thought it would be different this time, I have to say. When I listened to the it was a BBC broadcast from Nick Robinson on the 25th of February, so the second morning of the war. And he guided listeners' eyes around the city saying, look over this dynamic, vibrant European city. I thought, I haven't heard BBC journalists refer to Kyiv like that before. And I've been following Ukrainian affairs for a long time. I've written a book about it myself. And I thought, I wonder if this time Ukraine's friends won't vanish and they will actually stand up and help. I mean, you've written about how the support wasn't quick enough, the support wasn't enough, and I fully agree with you. But nonetheless, I think the support has actually outpaced what I thought would happen at the very beginning of the war. Is that something that surprised you too? And why do you think it was different this time?
I mean, was I surprised? Maybe. Yeah, I think it was different. First of all, Ukraine didn't have France in 2014. 2014, it was still this obscure country, you know, corrupt, we don't know, they're probably Russians, other real country. And in fact, there was no help. You know, 14,000 people died in 2014, 2015. President Obama at the time refused to send any meaningful help and said on the record that there is nothing the U.S. can ever do to stop Russia from controlling Ukraine, full stop. And, you know, everyone else, you know, Germany was more than happy to move on and, you know, sign the Nord Stream 2 deal. You know, Obama was much more focused on getting Russia to play ball with him on the Iranian, you know, nuclear deal negotiations. And so Ukraine didn't really matter. But I think those 8 years, lots of things happened in Ukraine. I mean, first of all, you know, Ukraine showed that it is a democracy, a functioning democracy. You know, President Poroshenko lost an election to President Zelensky and, you know, without any drama, yielded power. So it had shown that it's able to have a democratic transition. I think also the fact that, you know, Ukrainian society, especially the youth, you know, have grown up in these 8 years of divorce from Russia. You know, the fact that borders were opened, the Ukrainians could, you know, go on the weekend to Vienna or Berlin. And the Europeans, you know, would go to Ukraine for, you know, from anything from stag parties to, you know, just holidays. So I think that this people-to-people contact with Europeans especially was something on a much higher level than what's happening before.
Right. I mean, this struck me as well. And I had the luck or the chance to work on visa liberalization for Ukraine on that back in 2016. And that ability for people to travel, to show that Ukraine, far from being the great unknown of Europe, as Lonely Planet had called it in 2012, Ukrainians were just like us. And they could show that. And with that situation of similarity plus moral clarity, and as you say, the developments that had gone on in Ukraine over the previous 8 years, from the revolution of dignity, the Euromaidan, to the democratic development in the country, I think that formed a powerful combination of showing why Western leaders should stand up, but also there was a groundswell of public opinion in the West saying, this is wrong, something needs to be done about this. But despite that, Aaron, there have been a lot of misunderstandings still, haven't there?
Definitely. And I also think that part of those misunderstandings come from how the West also reacted after 2014. As you said, the Germans were very happy to sign the Nord Stream 2 deal. So on one hand, I think that the people-to-people context, that's a very good point. And I think that also played a big part in why we saw the groundswell of public support. Also here in Germany, it must be said, at times that, as we've highlighted before, has repeatedly outpaced the government. But was there perhaps in Ukraine any potential consternation that perhaps the West would revert to form at any point, particularly in the first little while, and just say, okay, well, you know, the Europeans, in particular the Germans, might just want to go back to business as usual with the Russians as fast as possible?
Well, I think the events were really fast moving at the time. And, you know, the Ukrainians didn't really get much help in the decisive first couple of weeks of the war. I mean, we all talk about the Western weapons, but I mean, the US supplied a total of 90 javelins, 9-0, before the war began. You know, it's, you know, against thousands and thousands of Russian tanks and fighting vehicles. And so the initial blitzkrieg plan to take Kiev by Putin in 3 days was defeated with Soviet-made weapons that were in the Ukrainian arsenal before the war. You know, all this Western artillery and HIMARS and everything else came into play much later. You know,
there were some N-laws and so on that have been delivered before, but the numbers, as you say, weren't there. So they came from the UK and from other places.
Right, the N-laws were, you know, I mean, Boris Johnson, you know, pushed through a meaningful number. So I actually did see N-laws in the battlefield. I did not see any javelins until the summer.
Right.
When, you know, thousands of them were supplied by then.
Right, yes, St. Javelin's season is the summer, as we know. But indeed, yeah, I mean, there's a misunderstanding about that. It wasn't that immediately the West jumped in and supplied all that was needed. And a common theme when we've spoken to Ukrainian guests on the show has been the very sad truth that the West seemed to have to wait for another tragedy, another massacre, another upscaling of Russian brutality to upscale their assistance. So after Bucha comes the artillery. After Mariupol comes the HIMARS, et cetera. And this must have been a truly awful thing for Ukrainians to live through, to see that linked support to the killing. Is that what it felt like there?
Well, very much so. You know, I'm not a Ukrainian official, so I can be frank. You know, they have to be very thankful and kind of keep their bitterness private. But, you know, there is a lot of resentment in Ukraine about how slowly this aid was provided. And I mean, the analogy I hear a lot is about extinguishing a fire. You have a fire going on and you need a bucket of water. And Ukraine got its bucket of water. It got this tens of billions of dollars in aid, but in little coffee cups over 2 years. Mm. And, you know, and if you do it drip by drip, that does not extinguish the fire. And so that's why these delays had the fundamental effect in the battlefield. Because, you know, every time the new capability was introduced, be it HIMARS, you know, being the Leopard tanks, be, you know, F-16s in the future, you know, they come in such small numbers and so slowly with so much advance warning that the Russians have the time to prepare and to deflect a lot of their ability. Now, HIMARS now are a lot less efficient than they used to be because the Russians learn how to jam the GPS, you know, how to, you know, revamp their logistics. And so while they were very efficient, you know, for a month or two or three in the summer of 2022, now they're just, you know, not nearly as efficient as they were. And that has been the problem all along, because the supply never came in a critical enough mass to make a massive difference in the battlefield.
Yes. I mean, this is another thing that we've seen and talked about repeatedly, is the missed opportunity of 2022 there, where the Russians were there for the taking and it was dithering, particularly in Berlin, but also in other places, that lost us that opportunity. There must be a tremendous amount of bitterness about that, about how many more people had to die and how less likely the victory became, or how much more drawn out the war has become because of that. Is that something people talk about a lot, that delay?
Oh, yeah, very much so. I think it's not, I don't think it's just the Ukrainians. I think there are people in Europe who also realize that. Not necessarily, in the administration in Washington, because I think there's a lot of patting themselves on the back and telling each other that, you know, we already won the war, Russia's already defeated because they didn't take Kiev. But, and I write about this in the book. So if you look at this, the objective situation in the summer of 2022, so Russia by August had about 100,000 combat troops left in Ukraine. Because the cream of the Russian army, the VDV airborne forces, and most of the professional units were destroyed by then. And President Putin was refusing to carry out a mobilization because doing so would have meant acknowledging that the so-called special military operation is not going to plan. Right. So Ukraine had, despite being a smaller country, had a massive advantage in manpower. What it did not have an advantage in was firepower. And so it was asking, you know, it was not asking for the moon. It was asking for what it got the following year. It was asking for, you know, hundreds of tanks, you know, hundreds of MLRS systems, you know, several hundred artillery pieces. And it was all dismissed out of hand as fantasy. You will never get this. How can you ask for this? And so when Ukraine actually broke through Russian lines and exploited this advantage of manpower in Kharkiv, it couldn't finish the job because it just ran out of supplies. And at the very same time, Putin very successfully used nuclear brinksmanship to make sure the West would not increase its supply at the time.
Right. I mean, this, it seems as though a lot of Western leaders, in military leadership as well as in political leadership, were still stuck on crisis management mode of from the previous 15 years or so of military operations, rather than war-winning mode, where you have to seize those opportunities, strike quickly, follow it up. You don't throw a jab, stand back, see how it's gone, and then maybe think about another one. You follow it in. And that it seemed as though that lack of killer instinct was there in the West as well.
Well, it's if you look at this sort of like how... The pattern of behavior, it seems that the main priority was not to provoke Russia into a nuclear response, which means that Putin very successfully used this nuclear brinksmanship to not to cut off Western aid, but to throttle it to a level that was slow enough, low enough to prevent a defeat of the Russian forces.
And I think this also goes a little bit as well into how Western leaders understand diplomacy and how they also understand how Russia uses diplomacy. Russia uses diplomacy in a way that is very, very, very different to the ways that we use it, or that we at least fancy ourselves as using it. Critical distinction to make there. And in your book, you talk quite a bit about the early negotiations. So Istanbul, those sorts of summits. And to me, that suggested another recurring theme. Russia presented its withdrawal from suburbs around Kyiv, like Bucha and others, as a diplomatic gesture, right? In reality, as you write, it was a military necessity. You know, it just didn't have the ability to hold those places. Yet I think that this kind of faking out by Russia also on the nuclear issue, but on this one as well, it's a common thing we see in Russian diplomacy, it still seems to convince a lot of Western politicians. We have social democrats here in this country wanting a negotiated peace to freeze the conflict, but there's no indication that Russia really does want to negotiate unless it wants to legitimize its occupation. It uses
there's no understanding of how what that would take. It would take a German division in Ukraine to actually back that up, which no one's willing to send. So, I mean, it's pie in the sky, but it does show that sort of still dealing with the Russia we wish we had rather than the Russia we had.
Yeah, the Russia that, you know, social democrats in particular, but also others in other Western capitals think, you know, is interested in some kind of negotiated settlement or way out, when in fact it's not. It's interested in diplomacy for something entirely different. Why do we seem to keep getting this so wrong, despite the number of years we have of experience with it?
Well, I think, you know, it probably speaks to the vision of the world, and also that sort of, that, you know, thinks that anything can be solved peacefully, which is maybe true for debates within the European Union about tariffs. but not necessarily when you're dealing with a, you know, with an aggressive neo-colonial power. And I think what I hear a lot from Ukrainians and actually like Russians in opposition, has to do something with the life experience of many people leading governments in the West who have never seen a war, have never served in the military, and have never had an experience of violence in their lives and don't know how to deal with violent people.
That's so interesting. I mean, we're at the 75th anniversary of NATO's founding these weeks. And one of the real common factors between the politicians who set up NATO, the leaders of national countries at the time, the first Supreme Allied Commander, Hastings Ismay, the first Secretary General, think of politicians like Harold Macmillan or so on at the time. They'd served. They'd actually seen combat themselves. War and violence was meaningful to them. They understood what it took to fight and to win. And we don't have that anymore.
No. I mean, who was the last U.S. president serving the military? George Bush father.
No? Right. Yeah. I mean, the Texas Air National Guard doesn't count quite so much, I think. So George Bush Jr. misses that one. But yeah, I mean, this is what many people think. It was a shame John McCain never was elected because he did have experience of serving. And he was someone who at the time when Barack Obama was saying there is nothing we can do, he took a very different stance. But it seems as though Washington at the moment is caught somewhere between the two. It's not committing. I mean, what is your take on that, on why the Sullivan-Biden axis is not working to deliver victory for Ukraine?
Which, by the way, also is moving in lockstep with Olaf Scholz in the chancellery, particularly on Ukraine.
First of all, the White House was quite happy to step away from Ukraine when it all started. The idea was, we'll walk away, we don't fight this war, then it's not our loss. And so the fact that the embassy was closed and basically an invitation was made, do what you want, it's not our problem. Here Ukrainians have a box of javelins, enjoy your insurgency. That was the policy at the time. The U.S. sort of got dragged into backing Ukraine by the fact that Ukraine didn't collapse, by the public opinion. And a lot of the decisions that were made were reactive decisions. I don't think President Biden or Jake Sullivan were expecting, in March 2022 to have made such giant commitments to Ukraine that were made in the following 2 years. I think the Russian nuclear factor is still a constraint. Again, there is still this fear. I think, but also there is the issue that, in Europe, a lot of the sort of, not just Putin vegetarians, but, open Putinists, on the far right of the political spectrum, stopped being so when the war began. So you see in Italy, you see even Le Pen in France, they're not praising Putin. They're not necessarily supporting the war in Ukraine, but, the language has changed, in part because Ukraine is a real-life issue in Europe. Everybody knows Ukrainian refugees. Everybody's familiar with the tragedy. It's something unpalatable to be pro-Putin openly in Europe now. But in America, there are very few Ukrainian refugees. It's still very abstract issues. And so the number of politicians who are very openly rooting for Putin in the U.S. Congress is quite high on the fringes of the Republican Party and in American politics. And so because the war in Ukraine ultimately is not a national security issue for the American homeland. It is, who is in charge and who controls Kiev, let alone Lviv, is a national security issue for Poland, for the Baltic states, for Germany, and arguably for France, with President Macron saying it's an existential war for Europe. But it's not an existential war for the United States of America.
No, the effect, the lever is longer, that's for sure. I mean, we've made the argument before that this is a matter of American vital national interest because it affects America's ability to order the world in ways that actually benefit Americans and America as such, but it doesn't have quite that direct connection. It is a much more existential issue for Europe. But what then baffles us a little bit is why some Europeans think it's okay to follow that line that Sullivan and Biden are pushing through.
Well, I think... Again, there's probably lack of understanding of the historical gravity of the moment. And again, people who have not experienced cataclysms have a hard time understanding how likely they are. I mean, arguably, people in Kiev did not expect the war to happen. because they didn't have an experience of the war. And so I think the failures of imagination have been a feature of all this. You know, nobody could imagine that, you know, Ukraine would invade Russia. Nobody would imagine that Russia would invade Ukraine. And now a lot of people cannot imagine that Russia would test NATO and the European Union in a few years.
Right, because it seems so crazy to do so. And we wouldn't do that, and we're not crazy. So, you know, let's imagine they're not and hope for the best.
Yeah, so we're talking about a moment where, you know, the inconceivable becomes real. And then suddenly there's a new inconceivable, which really is all about Russian strategy, is it not? You know, creating new inconceivables and somehow building up a tolerance for what used to be inconceivable. And yet there's still this sort of tendency to assume that Putin and the Russian regime is behaving in some sort of rational way, that they're kind of grandstanding about what they want. Maybe, you know, what they really want, according to some people who want to, quote unquote, freeze the conflict, is they just simply want to keep Crimea and they want to keep the Eastern territories, when in fact Putin and Medvedev are on record saying, no, we want the whole country. This is what we want. Why are we not understanding Russia in the right way in terms of how it goes about what it wants?
And what does Russia want?
Also, what it strikes me here, you wrote about how Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba, his talks with Sergei Lavrov in the early days of the invasion, and how Kuleba remarked how Lavrov and the Russian regime really seemed to now believe their own narrative. This wasn't something that they were simply spinning. You know, Lavrov seemed to actually believe that Ukraine was full of neo-Nazi Russophobes, and he needed to believe this in order to, you know, press ahead with this particular policy. Are we taking this seriously enough in the rest? We assume that Russia is somehow rational, that it wants something that it's not telling us, but what does it want, and are we making the wrong assumptions about it?
That's a very good question. And, you know, the presumption of rationality is based on the idea that, you know, we all have the same reality. But if you live in a different reality, then, you know, your behavior is different. I mean, the invasion itself was based on the idea that Ukrainians are Russians and the Ukrainians will welcome Russians with flowers because they all love us. And it's just, as Putin wrote,
instead there were sunflower seeds.
Yeah, exactly. And it was just a small clique set up by the CIA that is, you know, preventing them from reuniting with the brotherly Russian people. So that was the reason why the Russian military was not prepared. Now, I think what, you know, as Medvedev and Putin and others in Russia have made it very clear, they still want all of Ukraine if they can get it. Now, as to the how far their beliefs are removed from reality, it's a very good question. You know, Bucha, you know, the Russian propaganda keeps saying that Bucha was never happened. It was, you know, stage CIA, PSYOP, you know, crisis actors and all that stuff, despite, you know, plenty of evidence, you know, the filming of the Russians executing prisoners, you know, it's just one of the most documented war crimes in the history of war crimes. The question I have is, and I ask this to a lot of people who sort of know the Russian system, do you think Putin believes that the Russians did nothing wrong in Bucha? Or do you think Putin believes that it was the Ukrainians, not ISIS, that blew up the Crocus Concert Hall in Moscow? And the answer I have is he probably does believe that it was the Ukrainians who blew up Crocus, and he probably does believe that Bucha was staged. Just like, you know, if you ask, does Donald Trump believe that he won the election in 2020? He probably does, because otherwise Putin's entire conceptual worldview, you know, has to crumble.
Yeah, so it's not just cynicism, it's actually true, but they've drunk the Kool-Aid.
Exactly, which drives policy, which, you know, makes Russia even more dangerous. And, you know, if you listen to what people like Patrushev, you know, the Russian national security guard, say, you know, they're outlandish, it's even more scary that these people probably believe a lot of it.
Right. And this, again, as Aaron said before, we're still not taking this seriously. Partly, I think, as you mentioned, because of this failure of the imagination that we have, the failure to put ourselves in the shoes of others as well, to understand there are different rationalities in operation that have different goals than we would have in that situation. And we need to get out of that arrogant mindset, that's for sure, to be a little more flexible. But in terms of bridging that gap of imagination, that's something I think your book does a wonderful service of actually doing, is to bring that visceral experience, as I said. So if you were to convey some messages to people around Western Europe, around Germany and others, what are the big misunderstandings about how the war is being fought and about the reality of war that you would convey from your time in Ukraine?
first of all, just the toll of the war, just the amount of killing and death and destruction that is occurring in Ukraine every day, you know, hundreds of people die in Ukraine every day, is really difficult to convey to people who have never witnessed that, never seen that. I mean, the lived experience of, you know, cities that are being flattened, you know, Bakhmut yesterday, you know, Avdiivka, now it's, you know, Kharkiv is being once again, you know, bombed every day with Russian bombs. And those are all people who had lives that were very similar to the lives that people in Europe or the US had before the war began. Same ambitions, same goals, you know, holidays, career, education. And what really struck me is that in Kyiv before the invasion, the full-scale invasion, very few people believed that this was happen, that this would happen. And everything was kind of normal. And for me, having seen how normality turns into war in sort of in one instant in other places, you know, I could see this, I could sort of have this sort of foreboding of all of this being shattered. But problem is that people in other places in Europe also live in the illusion that this can never happen here, and it can.
No, absolutely. And that's something we try and convey in both the writing that we do and the podcast as well, is talking about that sense of vulnerability that we should actually have and a sense of fragility we have, but we don't. We're so insulated, or we think we're so insulated from this. And a lot of Germans will say, for example, but, you know, it wouldn't touch us. They, the Russians, would have to, quote unquote, come through the Baltic states, come through Poland to hit us. Well, a brief look at the missile strikes that Russia is happy to visit upon population centers of any kind should be enough to wake people out of that, but it still hasn't. And I wonder, I mean, these personal experiences you talked about, this was something that struck me in the book as well. As you said, people with normal dreams, normal lives to live, being busy on a Tuesday, trying to rush home to get dinner for the kids while make sure they keep that project alive at work and so on. That was them. And then they got transformed. Maria, the medic, who appears in chapter 41, as well as other places, the Battle of Terni, she was one of those people. She was studying somewhere else, wasn't she?
Yeah, so she was studying in Poland, like many Ukrainians. And the reason she was studying in Poland is because her mother, after 2014, didn't really want her to, you know, do anything dangerous. But she came back. She came back to Ukraine after having, you know, after working a good job in Poland. And as the sort of clouds of war started gathering, she trained as a medic. And when the war began, the full-scale war began, she told her mother she's going to a camp for children in Western Ukraine to be a camp counselor. And instead she enrolled in the military and she ended up in the front line. So her call sign was camp counselor, Vozhata. And it's only after the volunteer battalion that she enrolled in, you know, became part of the formal military several months later that she came home with some medication to tell her mother the truth. And her mother fainted, as expected, so she had to administer some aid. But that's you know, that's the kind of personalities you find. And, you know, Maria, sort of we followed her through some of the worst battles in the Ukrainian drive to liberate parts of Donetsk province, sort of one of the last lands that were regained there in the fall of 2022.
Yeah, after that, there was a real jouissance to that time as well, when the fast-moving advance was going from Kharkiv. We all saw the footage of people driving on armored jeeps and so on, firing machine guns, taking kilometers in a day, which... Mm-hmm. Was really something that I think a lot of people really responded to and thought, terrific moment. But we've seen the character of war change
a lot
as well.
So this was the moment, as I said, when the Russians had 100,000 troops in all of Ukraine and advantage of manpower. The reaction after that, days later, was Putin announcing a mobilization, 300,000 that were announced, plus, you know, many, many tens of thousands more recruited in the Russian prison camps into Wagner and then directly into the military. And then all the other hidden mobilizations ever since. So Ukraine no longer has a manpower advantage, and it never had an advantage in ammunition or in all the other gear, in artillery, and, you know, certainly not in planes. And so now, you know, Russia has had all this time to dig in, to create the fortifications and minefields, and that really made it very difficult for the Ukrainians to succeed in the counteroffensive that was launched, you know, several months later. But I think also what we've seen is that the nature of warfare has changed, generally speaking, because of the developments in technology. I think people in Western militaries are learning, not enough, from the experience of that war, because it's been transformational. It's very, very hard for anyone to advance now, because any advancing you cannot mass troops anymore because they're discovered almost immediately with drones, and anything that's discovered can be destroyed. So we have seen columns of tanks and fighting vehicles that the Ukrainians had, including the German tanks, trying to advance in Zaporizhia and being knocked off in September, October last year. But now we're seeing the same images every day of the Russian columns trying to advance. And if you look at the, the tanks were made to fight against other tanks historically, but the statistics are now about only 5% of tanks in Ukraine, in the Ukrainian war, are being destroyed by other tanks.
But this changing nature of adaptation, the adaptation battle, is something that McRyan and others have written a lot about. But one personal story that brought that home in the book, again, was the story of Valentin Koval, who was the crew member, one of the crew, or the commander of the first HIMARS unit that was trained. That was, I found to be an interesting story, also because of what then happens to him later.
Right, yes. Yeah. So Valentin, he was initially working, serving as a young officer, as a unit lieutenant in the Ukrainian Uragan, sort of multiple launch rocket system, which, is a much cruder version of the HIMARS, And they were one of the units that were prepared for the Russians to come in. So they were loaded up with ammunition and sent to the forest of Chernihiv, northeast of Kiev, where they were waiting for the Russian columns to advance. And they, played a major role here in destroying the Russian sort of advance units in the area. But there was a lot of heavy work, and unlike the HIMARS, the Uragans have to be loaded by a special loader, which broke down. And it's a very, very heavy rockets that they're using. And so a lot of the soldiers in his unit were veterans of the fight in Donbass, so they had some improvisation. So they used their belts, and literally, a dozen men with belts managed to use them as levers to load up these missiles and to destroy the Russian column. And so when the first HIMARS were promised, Valentin and his men were among the first people to be sent to Germany to be trained in how to use the HIMARS. And I think there was only four of them sent initially. And so these four trucks were driving up and down the front line, from Kharkiv to Kherson. Yeah.
And when asked what time is it, the answer was
HIMARS o'clock, obviously. That had a major impact for a short time on the Russian ability to replenish the military. They destroyed a lot of, because the Russians built their logistics network outside the range of Ukrainian artillery, but it was now within the range of HIMARS. And so all this ammo depots and stockpiles, went up in flames one after another those few weeks. But, the Russians have adapted since then. They learned how to jam the GPS signal, and they have dispersed the logistics. And so HIMARS now is nowhere near as efficient as it used to be.
Yeah, and poor Valentin also was hit, right? And he lost his legs.
Yeah, well, he lost one of his legs.
He lost one of his legs.
The other leg he thought he had lost, but he saved it. And again, it's a story that's very inspiring because, to me as a journalist, but also as a human, is so many people were so moved by reports of what's happening in Ukraine, by the images that they were seeing, by the courage and the suffering and the experience of the ordinary Ukrainians, that some went to Ukraine to fight, some went to Ukraine to help. In this particular case, there's an American philanthropist, Ahmed Han, who was helping this HIMARS unit, and when Valentin was injured, he arranged for him to be taken to Switzerland. He paid for his treatment, kept him in a house, by Geneva, and his leg was rebuilt, and so he's now back in Ukraine, back in the military, and he's able to walk.
Wow, I mean, that's an inspiring story of courage twice over. Let's talk about a couple of the other figures who appear in the book. There's another person who returned who came from a very different background than Maria, the medic, Vsevolod Kozhemiako.
Yes.
Can you tell us a bit about him?
Well, I mean, he didn't really return. He was on holiday. Vsevolod Kozhemiako was...
Sure, but he could have stayed abroad, right? He had enough money, he had the connections.
Definitely. Yeah. So Vsevolod Kozhemiako was ranked by Forbes, I think, as the 88th wealthiest man in Ukraine with, hundreds of millions to his name, and he owns one of the biggest food agriculture processing companies in Eastern Ukraine. So he was he's from Kharkiv, and he was involved with helping the Ukrainian volunteer units since 2014. And he hired many of the Donbass veterans to work for his companies. And when I met him, he was speaking Russian. So he was skiing in Austria in Lech when the war began. So he drove to Vienna, left behind his wife and his kids, and then walked across the border to Ukraine. And he walked across the border with another character in the book, who is a tennis player. So he walked across the border with Sergei Stakhovsky.
Right, that's down at Medica, right? The one walking border crossing that you could use.
Yes, exactly, at Medica, yeah. The Polish coast. So there were, you know, hundreds of thousands of people trying to go the other way. Not that many, usually men crossing towards Ukraine.
And so the 88th richest man in Ukraine and the Ukrainian tennis star walk the other way.
Exactly. And yeah, Stakhovsky also, Stakhovsky was in Dubai when this happened. He didn't have to go back. He was living in Hungary at the time. You know, he had a beautiful wine business in Western Ukraine. And so the two of them headed back to fight, one to Kharkiv, one to Kiev. And Kozhemiako basically tried to do something different. You know, he felt that instead of joining the former military, joining these structures, it could be better used just creating his own. And so he founded, he basically established a battalion that now has become a brigade, using his own money, using the money of other volunteers that really played a key role in the battles around Kharkiv. And he was, I went with him and his men in the first engagement when they retook the village of Ruskolozova, just north of Kharkiv city. And then he was famously filmed reclaiming the Russian-Ukrainian border in September 2022, and walking a few steps into Russia and saying, sort of putting the stop sign, saying, okay, now there's a stop sign, you cannot cross to the Russians.
Right, but again, an inspiring story of personal courage, someone who could have ducked out, but instead went back. And so you see from across the spectrum of Ukrainian society, people who stood up and answered the call.
Right, and you know, let's be fair, I mean, you know, there are also Ukrainians who did the opposite. And there are, you know, lots of Ukrainian men who paid bribes to, you know, be smuggled across the border and escape the war. And, you know, there were heroes and there were cowards and there were traitors. And, you know, another character in the book, you know, is Kirill Stremousov, who was, you know, a famous, you know, anti-vax activist in the southern city of Kherson who worked with the Russians and became, you know, the spokesman for the Russian occupation until mysteriously dying. You know, once the Russians abandoned Kherson.
In Kherson, yeah, indeed. Yeah, I mean, another anti-vaxxer on the side of the Russians doesn't surprise me tremendously, it must be said.
Well,
the whole book is completely full of fascinating characters, and I'll leave you readers to discover those, rest them for yourselves. But there's a lot of very interesting information on people like Kirill Bodanov, who we've talked about on the show before, and Vitaly Kim, who's a governor of one of the regions in Ukraine. But Aaron, this raises some wider questions, doesn't it?
Well, yes. I mean, you have gone a lot further than a lot of Western reporters in terms of covering Ukraine because of the number of stories that you have from everyday Ukrainians like this from all walks of life, as we've been discussing just now.
And before, you mentioned exactly that gap in imagination, which these stories help to fill, I think, very well. But it's also, there's a gap in imagination the other way.
We hear a lot from Ukrainian officials about how grateful Ukraine is for the support that it gets from the West. But at the same time, there is always under the surface, behind a certain veil, an amount of frustration, which I think we would argue a lot of is very justified in terms of, as you put it, the drip of supplies and aids of weapons, as you've said, trying to fill a bucket of water over 2 years with coffee cups. So if we're talking about regular everyday Ukrainians that you've covered so well in this particular book, how do they in general feel about Western countries, particularly one like Germany or Europe as a whole right now?
I think unfortunately, you know, the longer the war drags, the higher is the toll and the more reluctance there is, especially now with the US aid being frozen. I think the narrative of betrayal is taking hold. And that's very poisonous and toxic in the long hold. And, you know, I mean, there is, unfortunately, an element of truth to it. You know, the U.S. had promised to stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes, and it's not standing with Ukraine now in terms of actual material help. And that is the reason why Ukrainians are dying, and that is the reason why Ukraine is losing territory. So, you know, and it will be a factor of the in the collective memory.
And this is a message I think it should be clearly understood around Berlin and around Europe, is that that narrative of betrayal is taking hold, and with very good reason. Yaroslav, what other messages would you like to send to the German public and to German decision makers? And a big hello to all our listeners in the Kanzleramt.
As we like to say.
we know are avid listeners to the show, about why the war needs to be won and what needs to be done to do that.
Well, I think again, we spoke about the study of imagination, but I think it's very clear that if Russia wins in Ukraine, it will use the resources of Ukraine to go further. You know, the entire pattern of Russian expansion was to conscript and mobilize, you know, the colonized peoples and go further. We've seen in Ukraine itself, you know, a lot of the manpower for the initial invasion were people forcibly conscripted in occupied parts of Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk, where pretty much every able-bodied man has been rounded up, taken from the streets and sent to fight and die. And so if Russia were to control the bulk of Ukraine, it would be so much stronger to go for the next phase. And they're not hiding, you know, their goals. I mean, what Russia demanded before the full-scale invasion in its negotiations was pretty much rolling back NATO to pre-1990 borders, right? It's sort of, you know, reclaiming Russia's rights to lord over Central and Eastern Europe, you know, including Germany.
And that's an interesting point. Yeah. I think many people here don't think that applies to them, but this is coming for you if we don't stop it in Ukraine. I think that has to be the message that is given loud and clear. And that is something, to be fair, that decision makers in London, decision makers in Paris have come round to increasingly and are increasingly willing to say. Decision makers and leaders in the Baltic states have been there from the beginning saying exactly this. But until we actually get that unified support with the materiel to match the morale that is there, we won't see the victory that we need. But very clear message there from Yaroslav Trofimov. Russia won't be done in Ukraine, so we have to get it done in Ukraine.
I think it's a message from the Russians. I mean, they're not really hiding their objectives.
They're not. I mean, they're very clear about what they want when they say, you know, this is the basis of our negotiation strategy. It's been nothing less than basically UN-legitimized annexation of Ukraine. And yet we don't seem to be taking this to heart. We assume that they're just bluffing. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence to suggest they're not. I'd like to ask one more question here, because it goes back to the mindset that we as the West collectively, I suppose, had at the very beginning of the war, not us personally, obviously. You detail very clearly examples of how the West and Russia as well treated invading Ukraine as a foregone conclusion, that Russia was going to win very easily within a number of days. And the West didn't see how it was possible for Ukraine to win at that point. Now, it's been 2 years, and Ukraine has clearly demonstrated incredible resilience, but that hasn't translated into full whatever we can support for Ukraine. So obviously here, that's about things like delivering Taurus cruise missiles. It's also about things like Europe in particular, but the whole G7 actually deciding to seize Russian state assets. Does Western reluctance come a little bit, does it come from not wanting Ukraine to win for fear of destabilizing Russia and then, you know, having that nuclear question hang over the thing? Or does it come from still not thinking that Ukraine can win? Somehow this hangover of what they thought all the way back in February 2022 that hasn't left the collective imagination.
I think it's all of the above. I think in part it's the nuclear fear. In part it's the fear of the unknown in Russia. You know, there's a lot of people think that, you know, Putin, after all, is not so bad. And the next person could be worse, which, you know, a lot of Ukrainians and Russians disagree with. And I think it's also unwillingness to bear costs. You know, for example, you know, Russia is able to, you know, reap, you know, a lot of money exporting its oil, and nobody has seriously talked about constraining that. In fact, the U.S. has asked the Ukrainians not to target Russian refineries, not even oil exports, but, you know, refineries that make fuel for domestic consumption, out of fear it could disrupt the oil markets globally ahead of the election. So, you know, that's where the priorities lie.
I mean, that seemed a truly open admission of the cynicism of that policy in a way that the mask slipped at that moment, I think, which was very revealing for a lot of people in Europe who hadn't realized quite what was driving US policy in that regard. I think it's very interesting also that you mentioned this prioritization of the possibility of a Russian collapse or of the next leader being worse or so on, determining European policy or Western policy, rather than focusing on the very real harm that Russia is certainly doing right now and will continue to certainly do in future. This unwillingness to bear costs as well is something we've talked about before, Aaron. It's the ultimate false economy. If we don't bear these costs now, the costs will only get higher.
Much larger in the future.
That again speaks to the failure of imagination.
There we go. So this is it. We need to win the battle for the imagination. And Yaroslav Trofimov, you're helping us do that with Our Enemies Will Vanish and with this podcast and the event that we're now going on to at the DGAP here in Berlin.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show. That is all for this episode of Berlin Side Out. Join us in the next weeks as we discuss German grand strategy, or well, lack thereof, and how it can address a world of authoritarians if it is, of course, applied appropriately. For now, though, thank you very much to our guest, Yaroslav Trofimov, and his book, Our Enemies Will Vanish, is available now. Thank you also to our project assistant, Julian Stückle, our technical producer, Hendrik Vena, and the Dega Ape team from Berlin. Auf Wiedersehen and tschüss.
Tschüss and double watching.